All right. Good morning, everybody. How are you doing this morning? Yeah? My name's Andrew. Great to see you, part of the team here. If you've got a Bible with you, you could turn to 1 Samuel chapter 14. While you're doing that, I'll tell you a story. So about 6 months ago, it was March, and I traveled to the UK with my son, Jake. He's 10 years old. And the trip proved to be more costly than I thought. So about a week before we left, the clocks went forward 1 hour, and I lost an hour of my life. But that's not a problem, because last week I got it back. All good, right? The problem was this. Booked the plane tickets, got the rental car, got over there on a Thursday, and found out that 2 days later, the UK clocks were going forward. I lost an hour of my life that I have not got back. I called the government and said, "Is there anything that you can do?" And they said, "We'd love to help you, but our website is down." You know, when you are young, you think that you're going to live forever. And you think you're invincible. Right? Right, Brock? But as you get a little bit older, you start to get a little bit more circumspect about time. And you start to think about it a little differently. It's probably part of maturity that I'm hoping that will start for me very shortly. But every single day, you spend 86,400 seconds you withdraw from your time bank. And some guy who has more time and a lot smarter than I figured out that by the time my next birthday, I probably only have 500 days of my life yet left. Once you take out sleeping and showering and traveling and miscellaneous shopping, all that kind of stuff, 500 days. Time is short. And I've been thinking about time. And I've been thinking about the significance of time. One of the words for moments that we have is from the Greek word atomos, which is a picture of atoms. Now, I was terrible at science growing up, so I am on super shaky ground. So my friend, Mr. Haydock over here, might bail me out at any moment. But there's two things that I know about atoms. Number one, they are very, very small. Told you it was going to be profound and deep. And that's significant because when we think about moments in our lives, sometimes the most significant moments are the ones that we miss. But the second thing about atoms is that they contain incredible potential for energy, nuclear energy. There's so much energy that's contained there. And so there's a disproportion between size and impact. John, is that good? Okay so far? Is that pretty good? I'm going to stop because lest I say anything else that would be wrong about that scientifically. When we think about our lives and moments of our lives, kairos moments, if you were, they're moments of significance. And how we respond to them directly affects the trajectory of our lives and those around us. And we're going to look at a story today about a guy who embraced a moment in time and saw some incredible things happen. It's the story of Jonathan. Jonathan's one of the unsung heroes of the Bible. So his dad was a guy named Saul, who was the first king of Israel. Wasn't that great a king, honestly. But it would have been expected that Jonathan would have been next in line to be the throne, except he wasn't. The throne was given to the son of a shepherd, a guy named David. Now, I wonder whether Jonathan might have felt feelings of jealousy, bitterness, anger, resentment, as circumstances might have gone in a way that he didn't expect. But far from it, because Jonathan became David's greatest ally, his closest friend, and somebody who was totally in touch with what God wanted to do in him and through him. So when we pick up this story, the Israelites are fighting the Philistines. You guys remember Goliath, the big dude? Yeah? And things aren't going that well. In fact, it says earlier on in chapter 13, it says that they had 3,000 horsemen, the Philistines. They had 6,000 charioteers. And what made it worse, they had as many soldiers, as numerous as sand on the seashore. I mean, think about that. Think Samuel's trying to make a point? But it gets worse. 94% of the army had left. They'd done one of three things. Either they had gone and joined the Philistine army, so they fought for who they thought was going to win rather than who they thought should win. Or they had gone and hid in caves because they were so scared, or they just gone home, bunked off. So it was only 600 left. And it gets worse. I feel like Eeyore is telling the story. They only had two swords. Two swords. Saul had one. Jonathan had the other one. So here's what happened. The Israelites ran out of weapons. And the Philistines were the only ones who could make weapons. So the Israelites snuck around with their farming utensils and said to the Philistines, hey, listen, would you guys sharpen this for us? Because we need this to go kill you. Well, the Philistines might have been bad, but they weren't completely stupid, so they weren't in a big hurry to do this. So they only had two swords. So that's the context of the story. So let's take a look at it. We're actually going to read the last couple of verses of chapter 13. So I'm going to start at verse 22. So on the day of the battle, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or spear in hand. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had them. Now a detachment of Philistines had gone out to the pass of Michmash. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man bearing his armor, come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side. But he didn't tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom were Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was the son of Ichabod's brother, Ahitub, the son of Phinehas. By the way, my son was a little impressed that Phinehas is actually in the Bible, not just Phinehas and Thurb, but anyway. The son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On the each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistines' outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Senna. The other cliff stood towards the north of Michmash, the other to the south of Geba. By the way, I was really looking forward to reading all those names in front of y'all. So, all right, so what's going on here? So Saul is the warrior king, and he is supposed to be going into battle, and God has promised him victory. Except that he realized he was outnumbered, his army had scattered, and he only got two swords. So you know what he does? He takes a nap. Now, lest we be too harsh on him, how many of you have ever had a bad day, life's overwhelming, and so you go home, and all you want to do is switch on the TV or take a nap because you want to shut it out? Yeah? I can relate to that. And that's what he does. He's like, he tries to shut out all this stuff, the reality that was going on around him. But his son, Jonathan, does something quite different. And we're going to see that Jonathan embraces a moment in time, a kairos moment. And we're going to learn what he does, and we're also going to see some kingdom principles through it. First thing he does is that he saw a need, and he positioned himself to respond. While everyone was sleeping, Jonathan woke up. Bible doesn't tell us whether God woke him up. He woke up by himself, or he was bothered by what's going on. It doesn't matter. The point is that he woke up and he saw a need. Now, those of you who have ever been in one of our missional communities or a huddle, you've probably heard about the learning circle. And in the learning circle, you have a straight line across which represents our ordinary life. And there comes these moments in time, this where God might be breaking through, and we have to make a choice. Am I going to continue just with the trajectory of where I'm going with my life, or am I going to stop and see what God might want to say to me? And so Jonathan saw the need. He says to his armor bearer, let's go slip through the valley and let's go pick a fight. Now you got to know something about Jonathan. Jonathan was pretty young, probably 18, 19 year old. And his armor bearer was even younger. Now an armor bearer is an interesting job. Basically, as an armor bearer, your job was to carry around the sword for the person fighting. That's a great deal. Until there's time for a fight, and then you've got to hand over your sword to that person, and, you know. Anyway, so I'm not sure I'd want to do that job, but anyway, he was the armor bearer. Let's slip through and have a fight. Jonathan sees that something needs to be done. He decides to get into the game. That's a critical point for us to think about, because for all kinds of reasons, we sometimes sideline ourselves from being part of God's plan. I know I have in seasons and moments for several reasons. Sometimes it's been the fear of what other people will think about me. Other times it's been fatigue. Other times it's been a focus on what the world defines as success rather than how God defines its success. Is that true for any of you? Maybe your family. Maybe your missional community. What if I'm wrong? You know, I spend quite a bit of time with young people, just mentoring them, and often I hear people say, well, I don't want to miss God's best, and so I just won't do anything until I figure it all out. And we get stuck. And we get paralyzed. Jonathan sees a need. And to follow God is to move with God. When the disciples were with Jesus, in order to follow Jesus, what did they have to do? They had to go wherever Jesus moved. And so there's movement to following God. It's not comfortable. It's not static. Jonathan sees a need. It reminds me of a phrase that we see in the Gospels, and it's this: when Jesus saw. If you look throughout the Gospels, you'll see that phrase at least a dozen times. When Jesus saw. Matthew 9 and 10. When Jesus saw the crowds, he said they were like sheep without a shepherd. When Jesus saw the woman whose son had died, he had compassion on her. Vision comes first. In fact, there's a principle of the kingdom that vision precedes provision. What I mean by that is that sometimes we see something that we're supposed to do, but we have no idea how we're supposed to do it. Does that make sense? So Jonathan is there and he sees this problem and he sees the need. And then what does he do? He moves over to the place where something can be done. He positions himself to respond. It takes initiative. When I was about 18, a guy came up to me. I had done a little bit of music by this time. And a guy said to me, look, he said, you should write some music and you should record an album. I said, well, I got three problems. Number one, I don't have time, I don't have money, and I don't know anybody who could help me do that. He says, well, you can figure out the time, and the other two, ask God to help you. By the way, it's awesome to have friends who are honest with you, isn't it? So I say, okay. So about 2 days later, I get a phone call from a guy who I don't know very well, and he says, hey, I heard you've done some music. Would you like to record any of it? And I said, well, I'd love to, but I'd have to write it first. He says, well, write it and then give me a call. So I write some music over the next few months, give the guy a call, and we set a date to go record this album. It was like an 8-track. You guys remember that? Oh, yeah. And then, you know, like when it was done, it was like on tape. Yeah. You guys remember tapes? You guys remember CDs? How many of you remember LPs? Some of the kids are like, is he like talking a different language? What's going on here? I love tapes. I love doing mixtapes, except that you had your favorite song and there wasn't enough time for it at the end, and then you were totally like messed up. Anyway, so whatever. So the night before we're going to go to the studio, he says, look, I'm really sorry. Something came up. I got to go out of town. I can't do it. And I said, that's all right. He says, but I've got a friend, and he is generally known as the UK's best music producer. Christian, secular, doesn't matter. And if I told you the bands that he had produced, including Spice Girls and four or five others like that. Anyway, so he said, look, this guy owes me a favor. Would you mind if he came over? And I said, no, I don't think. No, I said, of course I would. So I meet this guy. We record the album and, you know, and it gets done. And today, some of that music's probably been sold in about 45 countries. I tell you that not to tell you that I'm anything special, but when we have a vision for something, sometimes we know that we're supposed to do something, but we have no idea how we're going to get it done. And vision often precedes provision. What is it that God might be asking you today to do? That's the question we're going to be asking ourselves this morning. You know, we pray for God to open doors, but Jonathan's posture and position opened the door for God to do something awesome. Isn't that amazing? Verse 6. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of these uncircumcised fellows." And then if you've got a Bible that you can write in, I'd underline this next couple of sentences. "Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or few." Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or few. Not only did Jonathan position and see a need, but he was willing to embrace the tension of certainty and uncertainty. Jonathan was certain of some things, while at the same time being uncertain of others. I mean, you gotta love what he says. Basically saying to his armor bearer, "Look, let's go pick a fight and maybe God will help us." If I'm the armor bearer, I'd be like, "Jonathan, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go back to bed, and when you're a little bit more sure, why don't you wake me back up, and then we'll talk about it again." He was willing to embrace a tension of certainty and uncertainty. He knew some things, he knew something needed to be done, but he didn't know how or what yet. I was driving back from a concert a long time ago now, and all of a sudden I hear doo, 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 and I realize that I'm driving by Braille and I'd fallen asleep. And in the instant I woke up and it made me realize that life can be taken away in a moment. A friend of mine, we were driving to a meeting last week and my tire blew out on 69. And everything was fine. We were able to pull over and change it. But another 10 seconds and a car could have gone out of control. The point is this, that none of us can control when we die and how we die, but we absolutely can control how we live. Look, Jonathan's saying something needs to be done. He had such a clear perspective on reality. He knew that God was strong enough to meet their need, whether just there was two of them or 2,000. He had an absolute resolve that God's character and God's capacity and competence could save them. He just wasn't sure how it would all take place. And so he was willing to embrace that tension. There was a guy in the UK who was a very famous entertainer, got diagnosed with cancer. And an interviewer said, "Well, you've been told you have 3 months to live. What's that like?" He says, "It's not bad." He says, "You can't even guarantee that you have tomorrow." So we find ourselves in between this tension of what we know and what we don't know. Let me illustrate it this way. When I was teaching my son Jake to swim, we finally got to the point where he had to jump in. And he wasn't that sure he wanted to do that. He had no idea what it was going to feel like, whether he was going to get water in his eyes, whether he was going to go underwater, what the whole thing was going to feel like. But he knew one thing. He knew that I would catch him. He knew that I would catch him. "Will it work?" Jonathan says, "It might." See, here's a kingdom principle. You focus on the who, not the how. You focus on the who God is, rather than the specifics of how it's going to work out. You know, one of my favorite verses is in Daniel chapter 11. It's actually from the New King James Version, or the King James Version. "Those who know their God will be strong and do great exploits." One's an upward reality, the other one's an internal reality, and the other one's an outward reality. Those who know their God. It's not this idea of just knowing as I know facts about God. The idea of knowing in the Hebrew is this deep relationship, deep connectedness. Those who know their God, who are absolutely convinced that God's character is good, God's power is unquestionable, will be strong and do great exploits. That passage comes in the context of great sin. William Carey, who lived about 300 years ago, he's really known as the first modern missionary. He said, "Expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. You know, when you look at the scriptures, you see that Israel was told that they would be victorious time after time after again, and yet we see them hesitate. And the reason we do that is because while we see victory as the absence of suffering, they were in the midst of seeing the pain and the sacrifice of what it took to see God's victory come. You guys remember my shack, your shack in a bungalow? Remember those dudes? They get ready to go into a fiery furnace. And they say, God is able to save us. But if he doesn't, we're still not bowing down before the idol. They're saying this, we don't know how long we're going to live, but we absolutely are convinced how we're going to live. And that's that tension that we live between, certainty and uncertainty. I tell you this, that every significant thing that's happened in my life has taken some measure of faith. And let me make this really practical, because sometimes we talk about these things and it feels quite abstract. About 5 years ago, I needed a job. Didn't have a job, didn't really have any money. And the only two things I'd really ever done was music and ministry. And because of the circumstances, which I shared a little bit last week, both those things couldn't happen. So we, Trish and I, start praying. God, we believe that you provide. Would you please, in our brokenness, provide? Well, about a week later, a guy calls me and says, look, I've got a company that makes telephone calls for CPAs in the UK. Well, I didn't know anything about CPAs. I didn't really know much about making phone calls. Had a phone. And he said, look, you'll need to start at 4:30 because of UK time. And I didn't know much about getting up at 4:30. So I remember the first morning I go downstairs. I'm sat in front of my laptop and my phone is completely dark. And I say, God, I have no idea what I'm doing. But I trust you. So please help me. I make my first phone call. No one was there. Make the second phone call. I talk to someone. Whatever. About 10 phone calls into it, in the database was a guy called Mr. Crapper, and he was a window cleaner. I mean, you can't make that stuff up. I called in a very nice conversation with Mr. Crapper, the window cleaner. Well, that first day, I made about 120 phone calls. The next day, I made about 120 phone calls. And 2 years later, I had made 100,000 phone calls myself. And God had not only done some work in my character, but he'd also built some new skills in me that I use today in my job that I love. And isn't that like our God? If we take a step and we're obedient, then God can move. You know, it's a cliche, but it's always easier to steer a moving car. That doesn't make so much sense now because that phrase was invented when there wasn't power assisted steering, yeah? I mean, my first car didn't have power assisted steering. You know, and you get to, you know, you'd start off and you try and turn and you get a hernia, you know? By the way, my first car didn't have electric windows either, so whatever. Anyway. Jonathan had no idea how God would act in this particular endeavor, but he knew who God was. Verse 7, do all that you have in mind, his armor bearer said. Go ahead, I am with you, heart and soul. That's an amazing phrase. You know, the armor bearer is not saying, all right, Jonathan, you are crazy. I mean, honestly, what are you thinking? But, I mean, you're my boss, so let's go do it. No, he says, I am with you. Do all that's in your heart. I'm with you with my heart and soul. Do you understand that Jonathan had such great influence that the armor bearer saw who God was in Jonathan's life and trusted and said, you know what? I'm in. I'm 100% in. As we embrace these moments in life, we have to realize that God has called us to be a person of influence, that we're not just supposed to do this by ourselves. Remember Matthew 9 and 10, I referred to earlier. Jesus sees the crowd. He says to his disciples, look, the harvest field is plentiful, the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into the field. So they pray this nice prayer. Jesus says, that's great. All right, off you go, boys. They're like, sorry? No, it's your turn. You guys are going. Pack your backpacks. Actually, on second thoughts, you don't need any backpacks. Can you imagine how those disciples felt? They must have enjoyed going with Jesus, never quite knowing what was going to happen, but Jesus got it under control, whatever. Hey, boys, off you go. It's your turn now. See, Jesus' model was multiplication. God always is concerned about multiplication. It's a kingdom principle. Multiplication matters. And Jonathan's influence was such that authority affects how someone behaves, but influence will change who they are. And he recognized that. And we're called to live that way. And our family's trying to live that way. And those of you who know our family, we know that we don't have a perfect family. In fact, sometimes I look at our kids and I think, oh my goodness, I'm the children's pastor. What am I doing? So what we try and do is we want to try and be a people of influence. So we just have people over to our house and we let them eat dinner with us and hang out with us. And, you know, we try not to throw food those days when people come. At least Trish and I don't. And then we sometimes will say to our kids, look, we're going to just pray for these guys. And we're not trying to do something different. We're not trying to do something profound. And sometimes when they pray, it's terrible. Sometimes it's good. But we want to be people of influence, just letting people see our lives and you letting people see your lives. When you think about the things that God might have called you to do, who could possibly do that with you? Who could do it with you? And if you can't think of somebody, ask God to show you. Let's say that you're pastoral and you like going to visit people in the hospital. Well, who could you call up and say, hey, do you want to go with me? I'm going to go visit that person. It's no big deal. You don't have to do anything. It's just that simple. Multiplication matters. And Jonathan had incredible influence over his armor bearer. Verse 8. Jonathan said, come, then, we'll cross over towards the men and let them see us. If they say to us, wait there until we come to you, we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we'll climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. Look, said the Philistines, the Hebrews are crawling out of their holes they were hiding in. The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come up to us and we will teach you a lesson. Next thing that Jonathan does was he stepped out of obscurity. He stepped out of obscurity. He says, let's go over towards the men and let them see us. You ever read stuff in the Bible and go, that's just weird? No? I mean, wouldn't you have thought that there was only a couple of them and they're facing all these guys, you'd want to sneak up, wait till they were asleep or they got completely drunk and then kill them? But Jonathan says, no, let's go up there and let them see us. Hello, here we are. I can imagine someone saying, look, Jonathan, this is why we picked David to be king. At least he might live. You're crazy. But anytime you see something in the Bible that's a little bit strange, you should pay attention to it, because I'm sure that God wants to teach us something. He says, let us go through the pass and let us see them. What is Jonathan saying? He's like, we can only do this by God's strength. And this is a moment where God will come through. See, the reality of this is that if you're going to do anything for God in his kingdom, there will be a moment when you have to take a risk. There will. It's absolutely unavoidable. Risk is unavoidable in the kingdom of God. That's the kingdom principle. Let me ask you a question. When was the last time you did something that if God didn't come through, you would be in a real mess? I'll tell you a story. So a few years ago, I'm in the UK leading worship at a conference. And in between the sessions, I'm out on the beach just preparing and just having some downtime. All of a sudden, I see a guy walking across the beach, and I think to myself, I should go talk to that guy. So I'm just about to get up, and the guy comes walking towards me. as he's doing that, I feel like God says to me, whispers in my heart, I want you to tell him how I feel about him using song. Yeah. That's exactly my reaction to you. I'm like, God, you gotta be kidding me. I mean, that's crazy. Have you guys ever talked to God like, I'm sure you guys are much, much more holy than I. I'm like, that's crazy. So now he's coming towards me and I'm like, oh, this is not good. Completely true. He comes up to me. I say hi. He says hi. I said, look, this is going to sound a little bit strange, but I feel like God wanted me to share some things about how he sees you by singing a song. And he looked at me and I looked at him and it was a little awkward. And so, all right, here we go. So I tentatively start singing the song. The guy starts to bawl, literally bawl. I get to the end of the song and he tells me what had happened. He said, the night before, he says, I saw you lead worship. And I was in the auditorium. Big, this is a big conference, 10, 15,000 people. And he says, I walked out. And I said, because when I was singing the song, he didn't believe it. And so he walked out and he said, God, if that's true, then you have to reveal that to me another way. He said, and you just sang that song to me one-on-one. He says, I cannot believe that God would care about me like that. You know, it wasn't comfortable, it wasn't fun, and if God asked me to do it again, I still wouldn't want to do it. But it had a profound impact, not because of who I was, but who God was in me. And for each of us, if we are going to take steps in God's kingdom, it means that we have to cross a line. And it's not one line, it's several lines. Because we default towards comfort and respectability and obscurity. But to be who God's called us to be, we have to step beyond that, where we're in a place where if God doesn't come through, we're in a real mess. I love what Paul writes in the end of Ephesians' letter. He says in Ephesians 6, he says, pray that when I open my mouth, words may be given to me that I may fearlessly known the gospel. Now think about the order of that for a minute. Pray that when I open my mouth, words might be given to me. What comes first? The words being given to him or his mouth being opened? Not a trick question. His mouth, him opening his mouth. It's the initiative that Paul was willing to take, saying, God, I want to move in this direction, trusting that when I do, you will meet me there and you will do more than I can do alone. He steps out of obscurity. I love how Jesus is constantly taking risks. He heals the leper by touching him or her. If it were me, I would have healed from a distance. He spends time around sinners and prostitutes. Remember we talked about last week, he uses the ceremonial jars that are supposed to be used for cleaning in order to take away shame. He takes risks. You know, I love roller coasters. I like them when they go down. I don't like them when they go up. I hate the clack, 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 clack. I hate it. Hate it. But there's a difference between being a thrill seeker and one who risks for the kingdom. One is about feeling alive for a moment. The other one is a momentum of life where you choose to give yourself for the sake of the kingdom, whatever it costs you. And Jonathan was willing to do that. Verse 12. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet, and with the armor bearer right behind him, the Philistines fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer followed and killed them, killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of over half an acre. Then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field and those in the outposts and the raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was panic sent by God. You know, he didn't hesitate and he moved forward. He didn't hesitate when it mattered most. He moved forward. It was counterintuitive, but it was not counter faith. Jonathan understood that you move with God. You know, what if we understood that you go unless you hear no? What if you understood that you go unless you hear no? What if we would hear the Great Commission as go to do something, as permission to be all that God's called us to be and to do all that God's called us to be, rather than always seeing, well, don't do that. Don't do that. Christians, don't do that. You go unless you get a no. You know, too many opportunities are lost because we're waiting for God to speak to us a word that's already been given. For Jonathan, to wait would have been a kiss of death. To go was a sign of God. To wait took a lot less effort. To move forward was a lot more dangerous. And yet, that's what he did. There's a guy who wrote a book called The Vision and the Vow. His name's Pete, and he wrote this. I want to read you just a portion. I was giving a friend a lift in my car, and we got talking about life. I don't know what God's calling me to do, he confessed. And he asked me to pray about what it might be. Why? I asked. I already know what Jesus wants you to do. You do? He gasped with excitement. So what is it? What's my call? I paused, enjoying the suspense. Drums rolled, strings tuned up. My friend held his breath. Your call, I said slowly, is to be a worship leader. He looked pleased, really pleased. So I continued. But not necessarily with a guitar in your hand. Okay, he murmured. Your call is to befriend that fun little lady at the end of the street. He seemed less pleased with that prospect. Your call is to feed the hungry and to spend yourself on behalf of the poor. By now he was looking distinctly disturbed. And to offer hospitality to strangers who just turn up in town needing a place to stay. Consternation. And it's to fast. He was starting to look furious. And it's to pray so long and hard that you ran out of words and tears. There was no going back. Your call, I continue, is to preach the gospel of Jesus to every person who will listen and a few that won't. Your call is to go somewhere, anywhere, wherever, where, whenever, for Jesus and never stop. Your call is to love people no one else loves and to forgive them when they treat you like dirt or worse. Do your job to your very best of your ability without grumbling about your boss or whining about your colleagues. Your call is to pray for the sick and when they're healed to dance all night and when they aren't to weep with them and love them even more. I glanced across at him and relieved to see his expression was starting to mellow. Your call is to honor your parents, pray for your leaders, study the scriptures and attend plenty of parties. Be a peacemaker in every situation when the fright breaks out on the bus home late on night and when gossip starts to circulate at church. Your call is to pick up litter in the street when no one else is looking. Wipe the toilet seat. Grab gum from underneath the desk. It's to get meetings early and put out chairs. By now, he was smiling. Your call is to make disciples and teach them everything Jesus commanded. And don't forget to minister grace to them when they sin, which they will. Your mission is to baptize and cast out evil spirits. Your call is to bind up brokenhearted wherever you find them. And you will find them wherever you look. It's to visit prisons and hospitals and to... Yeah, he interrupted, good-naturedly, trying to shut me up. But I was on a roll and I knew he couldn't leave because I was in the he was in my car and I was driving. Your call, I continued resolutely, is to listen more you talk and listen with your eyes as well as your ear. He was shaking his head in mock despair. I carried on. It's to do chores again and again without grumbling. By now we were both laughing. And I finally said, and when you've done all that, come back and see me, and we can spend a little time about praying about phase two. What if we heard the Great Commission as go, and we did all that God's already asked us to do? Jonathan understand the immediacy of what the situation needed and move forward. A couple of weeks ago, I felt prompted to call a friend of mine. Call him right away. He answers the phone. I said, hey, listen, I'm just driving, just thinking about you, just wondering how things are going on in your life. He said, well, it's really weird that you call. He says, because I'm just considering a move with my family to a different state. I said, wow, that's interesting. Well, you want to talk about it? He said, well, yeah, I can't now, but would you be willing to get together? So I get together with him about a week later. We have a deep conversation about moving, about significance, about choices, and about the things of God. He wasn't a follower of Christ. And And I don't know today whether he is, but I will tell you that he moved a significant step along the journey towards Christ. There are times when God asks you to do things and you should do it immediately. But when he doesn't, there's still lots to do. There's still lots to do. Climb after me. The Lord has given them into my hands. What was the result of Jonathan's posture and position and faith and risk and action? Well, let's take a look. Verse 20. Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines had gone up with them to the camp, went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who were hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined, the battle in hot pursuit. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on beyond Beth Aven. You know that Jonathan's yes enabled others to say yes. His yes, his passion, his risk, his faith before God opened the doors for others to say yes. And I want to live that kind of life. Do you want to live that kind of life? Where your choices, your passion for God is such that someone says, I want to be like that. I want to do that. That's the calling on our lives. What is God asking you to do? What is he asking you and your wife to do? What's he asking your family to do? Maybe you're a teenager here. What is God asking you to do? Because once he shows you, then you go to him, the God whose character is unquestioned. When you say, God, I know you're asking me to do this. I don't know how to get there, but I'm willing and I'm ready. And would you come and do something in me and through me? You know, we were just talking about Shepherd's House. Because of Kenny and Tracy's yes, other people have been able to say yes to God. Because of Aaron and Karen, some of what they've been doing up north, others are able to say yes to God. And that's the kind of life that we're called to live. Let's just spend a moment and just be still. Let's close our eyes. And I want you just to ask God this simple question. What is it that you're asking me to do? And just allow him through his Spirit just to prompt and quicken your heart. You can also ask God, who is it that you're calling me to partner with in this? Lord, thank you for your people. I pray that you would do a work in us this morning. That you by your Spirit would just quicken your purposes. But you would also give us passion for all that you've already asked us to do. Make us bold. Help us to trust you fully. I had this picture in first service. Sometimes God will give us a picture as just a prophetic way of just sharing about something. And a prophetic word is just simply one that prepares us so that when God says now, we're ready. It's just like a sprinter in the 100 meters prepares and gets everything ready, sets up their block. So when the gun goes off, they're ready to go. Well, a prophetic word is a bit like that. I had this picture of somebody on a bus. And I felt like God just gave the invitation that I'm not sure if it's someone who rides the bus regularly now or someone that God's calling to ride the bus regularly, but of relationship and influence that came through riding this bus, and it had kingdom fruit. So I don't know if that's you or not. If you think it might be, I'd love to pray with you after the service. But whatever God asks us to do, let's say yes.